part of Ahwal podcast and video series. And joining me from California, Ryan Gingeras, from Naval Postgraduate School, a prominent historian and also an expert on Turkish military issues, defense issues, and organized crime issues. I am glad to talk to you, Ryan, because the latest developments are exactly in your domain to comment about. The latest communique or declaration, or some say ultimatum, some say manifesto, by 104 ex-admirals, ex-Navy staff members, caused quite a stir in Turkey. The storm is still continuing. Dust hasn't settled yet. There are some repercussions. 10 of the ex-admirals are in police custody, and perhaps more to come. Four more senior figures amongst them have been called to come to the interrogation by themselves within 3 or 4 days. And Erdogan continues this on this path to comment and take some steps, part of which are basically targeting main opposition CHP party. But it caused quite a stir as well within the opposition camp, E party, CHP, except maybe HDP. So there are political and administrative repercussions out of that. But timing and also the style of the text and what it means, what it aims, the intention with it, etc. I think it requires a sort of a cool-headed analysis at this stage. What do you think?
I think there's a lot going on in this crisis, in and beyond just the petition or open letter itself. I mean, you could start with the letter and what it says and how it says it. Fundamentally, it's a call to government circles not to annul the Montreux Convention, and it does so ostensibly on three grounds. You know, one is that it's against the national interest. Two, that it had demonstrated a value in the Second World War in preserving Turkish neutrality. And three, and perhaps probably really the kind of the key here, is that it is a key legacy of Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, the founder of Turkey. And this is, by the way, a cliche that you hear a lot in contemporary discussions of maritime issues. For example, with discussion of Luzon and any kind of annulment or renegotiation of the Treaty of Luzon of 1923, specifically with respect to the islands in the Aegean and the Mediterranean, as well as broader relations with Greece, you have former military officers, among them being signatories of this letter, saying you can renegotiate it. This is one of Atatürk's greatest victories, and this is a term that's used in the letter, zafer. It is Atatürk's, it is a victory of Atatürk's. It also references issues regarding regarding secularism within the ranks, particularly the issue of perhaps members of the active officer corps participating in religious affairs, you know, which is sort of, I think, in some ways amplifies this issue with respect to Atatürk as well. That's a text. And I think then you kind of have to zoom out in terms of the broader context of this being undersigned by a really large number of former admirals, a handful of whom are rather prominent media personalities, the most prominent of which being Cem Gurdeniz, who is the, you know, reputed father of the so-called Mavi Vatan or Blue Homeland initiative. Somebody, you know, these are individuals with pretty profound nationalist credentials, people who very much represent, in many ways, the makings of the contemporary Navy, the present-day Navy in Turkey. That in and of itself, I think, is pretty significant, the fact that, you know, these 104 individuals would come together to undersign this. Now, I have to say, you know, just as a personal note, I missed the fact that Gurdeniz had undersigned this letter. I mean, his name comes down rather, you know, in the middle of the draft, and I initially thought he had not signed it, so I was somewhat confused that he was, he had been arrested and went back, and there he was, his name was indeed on the list. And so I think that kind of gets to a third issue, which is the increased presence of former military, not just naval, officers within Turkish media today, and as a force that both amplifies government policy, you know, as a kind of cheerleading element, especially in the use of military force and the execution of military policy, but also as a driver in trying to influence foreign policy. And, you know, front and center here is the Blue Homeland Initiative, which is the centerpiece of maritime policy now in Turkey, and has been a kind of a campaign from both inside the Navy, but also most importantly from outside the Navy, on the part of former admirals. And so, you know, what all of these different issues portend for the future of foreign policy, domestic criticism of the administration, and more generally sort of civil-military relations. I mean, now it's hard to say, but clearly there are some changes afoot.
Mm-hmm. Big changes probably are afoot. And as you mentioned, there are two aspects in the text. And one is about the Montreux Convention, Kanal Istanbul. Second one is the sort of ambiguously formulated part in which these ex-admirals sort of indirectly criticize the perhaps what we can call Islamization of the army, when one high rank officer is pictured as praying with a sort of whatever you the
robes,
yeah,
robes.
Exactly, robes. And but in the background there are two things, and many people point out to this part actually as more important. That caused worry and concern amongst these ex-admirals is that there were some changes were made in the bylaws of military schools, and some references limiting the acceptance of students with reference to their religious backgrounds, etc. And again, Atatürk's legacy. They were lifted. And second is something that's pointed out by Metin Gürcan, who was one of the founding members, an ex-officer as well, Land Forces, founding member of Deva Party. And he's pointing out a change in an official gazette, March 5, the sort of personal staff law that's changed so that up until now, all these appointments and sort of administrative power was within the General Chief of Staff. It was their jurisdiction. And both commissioned officers and the officers in duty are now falling into the jurisdiction of the the Ministry of Defense.
Yeah.
And Gürcan claims that this caused even deeper concern. What do you think about these two aspects?
I think it's certainly in the background, and you can add other issues too that I think kind of form...
The first one is about what we can say Islamization. Second part is what we can say is sort of...
power.
You know, redesign of the armed forces more and more in subordination to the ruling AKP.
I would, on the latter point, I would sort of refine to say that it's not simply about the AKP, it's about Hulusi Akar. And that I think an important component in this development, and this is ongoing, with, you know, decisions that have been made every summer with respect to promotion and retirement, that over the last several years, specifically since 2016, Hulusi Akar has made his mark in making this his officer corps. And among the attributes of this new officer corps is the promotion and the forced retirement of officers, depending upon whether or not simply their performance, but whether they're seen either as politically loyal, attracting too much attention. Certainly been a sense of speculation that he has particularly gone after the Navy and trying to rein in what is an emerging component of the armed forces that previously was somewhat secondary to the land forces, but is now gaining that much more influence over the direction of not just military policy, but foreign policy. So I think that's one element of it. So I think it's not just about the AKP, it's about Pelosi Akar. And so one way of reading this event, and again, this is highly speculative, is that this is as much a challenge to the AKP administration as it more narrowly is to Pelosi Akar. Since this is essentially, somebody who is, as a former member of the of the uniformed military, and a rather esteemed one, these are issues that conceivably he should be raising. I mean, at least this is how one could interpret it. The Islamization component, I mean, I think is an element that I think has rankled the certainly retired members of the military for quite a while. One could say this even predating 2016. And there have been sort of signs within, among this. And if you, spend any time sort of following former admirals on Twitter, if you watch them on TV, I mean, these are issues that do come up. For example, I believe it was the issue of, placing misdeeds at the naval, at military academies, or the, or the appointment of imams. Issues even as subtle as, I forget exactly what the context was, but the removing of references to Turkey or to Turks. In creeds, that are kind of commonplace within, within school, the implication being that this is a move away from the kind of ethno-Turkish nationalism of Ataturk, more towards the Islamic nationalism or Muslim nationalism that is more favored by the AKP. So I think, these are all things that are certainly in the background that I play a part of this, of what led to this point.
What do these aspects mean in terms of the, we know that the Turkish Armed Forces is subjected to massive changes, particularly since the attempted coup in the past four and a half years. What does it mean for the Turkish Armed Forces in terms of, in the context of NATO? It's part of the NATO. It's a big component of NATO defense mechanism. And its officer corps, of course, meaning part of the decision-making processes and cooperation, etc., etc. What do you think? What does it mean?
I can only speak for myself. I don't have any personal insight into it. But my sense is, and just in reading the statements made by senior NATO leaders, and certainly the initiative of the Turkish Armed Forces publicly, is that these are issues that are kept somewhat insulated from Turkey's overall participation in NATO. And that Turkish officers certainly have a presence in Brussels. They participate in NATO exercises, both collectively and also on a bilateral basis. There's, formally speaking, no change. And I think that the way in which, this is seen perhaps on the NATO side, again, sort of reading it from the perspective of how senior NATO officials have presented it, is that these are domestic issues that don't necessarily radiate into the interoperability of NATO. Doesn't affect mill-to-mill relationships between the various NATO members. What it has to do with the effectiveness of the armed forces, or what it pretends in terms of the future capacity of the armed forces, it's difficult to say.
But now, if these changes are, as the way many people analyze, including yourself, that sort of you know, the chasing away or the purging of what many people see as Gülenist segments within the Turkish armed forces, but including also many others, pro-NATO segments, pro-West segments, etc., etc. And if these changes now that we observe are telling us that Turkish armed forces will be having a sort of a prominent supra-identity as a Muslim army, you know, with the emphasis on Sunni Muslim identity, that will be quite a different situation now, because within NATO you will have these articulated parts upon an army. Don't you see this as a new challenge, new era, something to maybe a lot of people will start thinking about?
Yes and no. I mean, I think it's important to think about the Turkish Armed Forces in general as something other than simply a fighting force. It's a nation-building organization, and it has been that since, you know, for a long time, going back to the early stages of the Turkish Republic, and in some ways, going back to, you know, the late Ottoman period. It is an institution that, more than anything, is to instill values and a sense of identity tuned to the key of, you know, ideology in Ankara, right? And that has evolved considerably over time. And so this is, in some ways, not that new. I mean, there has been a long, slow drift in terms of how identity politics has changed within the military and the officer corps. And that's one component. And the other component, too, and I think this is becoming more and more clear over time, is that there are essentially two militaries. There is the military that is still largely used as a way of shaping identity among, you know, historically conscripts, you know, people as an institution that emits value, or sort of or who that shapes values of civilians as well, as a kind of as a model for Turkish citizenship, which is arguably not as engaged in foreign policy as we think, right? Instead, you know, when we look at what, you know, Turkish foreign policy and Turkish, you know, military adventurism is, you know, actually constitutes, it's a relatively small segment of the military. It's special forces, it's segments of the Air Force, most notably the Drone Corps. It's the emerging Navy, which is, you know, far more technically savvy, far more emphasis upon the use, increasingly, of, you know, a far more professionalized segment of the overall military class. So, in some respects, this, you know, the politics of all this, again, may be somewhat insulated, you know, depending on what segment of the military you're talking about. But the truth of the matter is, we don't really know yet. We don't know to what extent these sorts of controversies, or whatever sort of rifts they create, actually radiate into the operational capacity of the military, especially since that segment that is so active is a relatively small one.
We don't know yet, you said. Then my final question is, is the era of the Turkish Armed Forces as the, you know, guardian of the, you know, the Republican system as we know it, sort of ultra secular structure, is that era over? If we see the latest communique, the declaration by the ex-admirals as the perhaps the last desperate attempt to for a to to for a heads up, for a wake up call, or is it wrong?
I don't know. I mean, I'm a really bad fortune teller, especially when it comes to sort of the state of Turkish affairs.
Is this a
What
breaking ground? Let me rephrase it. Is this, are we on a sort of a breaking point?
I mean, if you were to consider it this way, I mean, in, you know, more than a decade ago, you know, a decade and a half ago, there were lots of people who said the Turkish military has been gelded. It's been returned to its barracks. It's not going to play a political role anymore. And there was a sort of a similar sentiment that, you know, that was left after 2016, you know, when you know, there were really clear questions over the political loyalties of the military. And, you know, obviously a lot has changed since then. And up until this last weekend, I would have thought that actually we're seeing a far more politically active officer corps than we would have previously imagined 5 years ago or 10 years ago. Mm. Does this change the script yet again? It could, but I would point to this sort of this one specific data point. It's relatively early. Is that it's clear that this is a challenge for officers who have political interests or who have certain, let's say, policy ambitions, for them to be able to navigate what are really sort of quite deep-seated tensions in domestic politics, balance those with what they think are the overarching, you know, greater issues of foreign policy. And what I'm thinking, who I'm thinking of specifically here is Jihad Gyaji. Mm-hmm. He did not sign this letter. He has remained rather quiet, although he evidently sent a text message late last night to a talk show basically saying that he's not getting to get involved in domestic politics, mm-hmm. and that what is most important is foreign policy. And mm-hmm. someone like him certainly, you know, exemplifies the ability of at least some officers to split the difference. I mean, one issue that, you know, very briefly kind of comes to mind is when he had his famous interview after he was forced to resign, he went out of his way to say that issues, for example, of the reconversion of the Hagia Sophia into a mosque was an issue that was not of his concern. This was actually an issue of the national will. That was what he had said. And then when he talked about his own ideological leanings, he called himself Milivedierli, you know, somebody who is national and local, which, as many of you, I'm sure, out there know, is a slogan of the AKP. Right. So this is somebody who's demonstrated a degree of savviness, somebody who will likely survive this new round and will remain influential, whether he's influential at the margins or more within the core of the officer corps, you know, we're going to have to see.
Is Erdogan right when he and his team, his administration, keep building their narrative on the coup still as a risk, still as something on the horizon, in the wake of this declaration? What do you think? Is a coup still on the agenda for somehow today?
I don't know. I mean, and I'd be loath to even guess. I mean, we were also wrong in 2016 when lots of us thought, you know, would have been impossible, right? And it happened. So,
right.
But I don't know.
It's hard to tell. Thank you, Ryan Gingeras, for this conversation, for these comments, and we'll continue this debate, I think, this conversation. This is a developing story still.
Thank you, everyone.
You can follow Ahval News Online podcast series through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Spreaker. All you need to know about Turkey is here, for your ears, mind, and attention. Thank you for listening to our podcast.